Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, how does immigration and the border define identity and belonging? We revisit a new book on borders and their impacts. And first, in light of the firing of Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem, we explore how the agency and ICE impact immigration discourse and the violence in policing of immigrants.
Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. Kristi Noem, the controversial Secretary of Homeland Security, was fired from her position in March of 2026. Her short tenure as Secretary was marked by numerous accusations of overreach of power, violations of due process, particularly with regard to immigrants without proper documentation, and the killing of protesters, notably in Minnesota, at the hands of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE. So, on today's show, we will review Secretary Noem's tenure at the department, the future of ICE, and the immigration raids that she instituted, and broadly the future of the Department of Homeland Security. Our panel is Naomi Paik. She is Associate Professor of Global Asian Studies and Criminology, Law, and Justice at the University of Illinois, Chicago. She's the author of Bans, Walls, Raids, Sanctuary: Understanding U.S. Immigration for the 21st Century, and Rightlessness: Testimony and Redress in U.S. Prison Camps Since World War II. The latter was a winner of the Best Book in History. And Luke William Hunt. He's Associate Professor of Philosophy at the University of Alabama. He's the author of The Police Identity Crisis: Hero, Warrior, Guardian, Algorithm, and Police Deception and Dishonesty: The Logic of Lying. Thank you both so very much for joining us. Professor Paik, Naomi, I'd like to ask you, now that Kristi Noem is out as Homeland Security Secretary, how would you judge her time in that position and what that has broadly meant for Homeland Security?
If you don't mind, I would like to kind of take the emphasis off Kristi Noem
Sure.
or off of any single person or figurehead or anyone in the in this administration, including Trump himself,
Okay.
because the problems with DHS and with ICE and with CBP, Customs and Border Protection, and even with USCIS, US Citizen and Immigration Services, they go much deeper and are much more pervasive than any one person. So I'm glad that she's out. I thought that, she was very self-serving, always looking for photo ops, even at a horrific torture prison of CICOT in Venezuela, or sorry, in El Salvador with Venezuelan migrants that we deported, not even deported, more like extradited there. So, I mean, I think your listeners probably feel the same kind of disgust that I feel, and no regret that she's no longer in the office. But removing her from the office doesn't shift anything. So I'd like us to shift from looking at figureheads, even really despicable ones, and really think in terms of infrastructure, right? And think about the infrastructure of DHS. And if we think about the infrastructure, then that even precedes the creation of DHS following 9/11 in 2003, right? So we have to go back to legislation even in 1986 with the Immigration Reform and Control Act, and particularly with several bills that Bill Clinton signed in 1996, particularly the Illegal Immigration Reform and Immigration Illegal, yeah, sorry, the era, the illegal immigration. Illegal Immigration Reform and Immigrant Responsibility Act, and also an anti-terrorism bill that were both passed in 1996. Those created a lot of the infrastructures that we're seeing mobilized by DHS and by ICE and CBP, right? It also flooded much more funding into enforcement infrastructure. So the hiring guards, thinking about bed space in terms of detention. Thinking about the infrastructure of deportation, like transportation networks, right? Facilitating international agreements with countries like Mexico and funding Mexican border enforcement so that migrants couldn't even make it to our US southern border. So all of these things really precede Kristi Noem, and they precede Donald Trump. And it is the product of a bipartisan kind of agreement that immigration and immigrants in particular from poor countries, colonized countries, mostly of color, are a problem to be solved through expulsion, detention, and deportation. This is like a kind of common sense. And so what we're seeing now with Kristi Noem, with the One Big Beautiful Bill, is more like an escalation of a long-term continuous process that has long been justified by the demonization of migrants. And if we don't deal with that, then it doesn't really matter who's in the office of DHS Secretary.
I think it's very important as a historical context, and the question of, has anything changed or has it simply intensified? Luke Hunt, I guess sort of a similar question that, I mean, do you see what DHS since the election of Trump, since the naming of Kristi Noem as the secretary, do you see that as kind of an extension of what policy has been in the past, maybe an intensification, or are there some decidedly differences in the way that DHS, and in particular on immigration enforcement, has changed?
Oh, well, first, pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me. Great question. I do see actually some significant changes since this administration came on and since Kristi Noem took over and even continuing today. I guess some of the most significant changes we've seen are a couple. So one, huge increase in the number of ICE officers. So a reprioritization of resources. Huge uptick in the number of arrests made by ICE, a dramatic change in how ICE agents are trained. So that's extremely important. And then when you shift gears and just to look at the changes in tactics, right? So I'm a former FBI agent, and I had on occasion years ago, instances where I worked with ICE officers, and the way they're operating now, it's really night and day. And this is all, apparent to the listeners and to everyone here, but we've seen a move away from more low-key investigations where they're very targeted, right? And then working in a sort of more subtle way to this very public, very aggressive swarming of cities, obviously, typically cities that are blue or Democrat cities, in a way that I would describe as, a much more militarized approach to policing that's out in the public eye. And there are a number of reasons for this. I mean, one reason that's been discussed quite a bit in the media and by scholars is this goal of trying to scare those who are here without documentation into self-deporting. And so that's one reason we're seeing all of this in the public eye. And I think, the biggest, or one of the biggest worries for me as someone who has a law enforcement background and has studied these things, is just to look at the tactics that we're seeing employed, right? And this goes back to what I said about the changes in training. Just clearly poor tactics, clearly officers who are not prepared to handle the situations they're encountering with protests and large amounts of people. Couple that with the lack of training and decrease in training, and we're seeing some pretty profound, devastating effects. Last thing I'll say on this point is I've seen a move away from the rule of law, right? So immediately after the deaths of Renee Good and Alex Preddy, Kristi Noem said, for example, or indicated, as did many officials, that there's not going to be an investigation of those shootings, that they were domestic terrorists, and that essentially these were self-defense shootings. And I could tell you, I won't go into it right now unless you'd like to, the legal standard for when law enforcement officers can use deadly force. But at a minimum, there was clearly a question about whether that met the legal standard. And to say that there's no grounds for even a thorough investigation suggests to me a move away from the rule of law and a lack of transparency and accountability.
We are going to delve into that, but Naomi, I want to sort of get your reaction. Now, you lay out a certainly compelling case that U.S. policy on immigration had this bipartisan consensus, this idea that immigrants are a problem that need to be solved. But clearly the amount of money the US is putting towards that has increased in the last 18 months or so. And it seems like the scope and scale has increased. Would you characterize it that way? That, I mean, this was a trend that then spiked as a result of the election of Donald Trump?
Yeah, absolutely. We can't deny that the One Big Beautiful Bill's $170 billion plus dollars that is going to be invested into immigration enforcement, that's real. And it's building up that pre-existing, building up even further that pre-existing infrastructure. But that infrastructure is pre-existing. So like the massive purchasing of these massive warehouses to make deportations work like Amazon, except with people. That is horrific. And it's only enabled because of this 170 billion. And also, we have had a long-standing detention network for a very, very long time that has detained not only adults, but children for decades. So that's the kind of thing that I want people to pay attention to, is that this did not start and it will not end, most importantly, when we get these people out of office. Right. And so, yes, the scope and scale has definitely increased. There are more ICE officers. They are hiring anyone, like literally anyone that they can get their hands on. And that is leading to an increase in arrest. There is this kind of escalation of the spectacle of immigration enforcement. But again, that is not a new thing. Right. Like we have had spectacular raids done in the past in a very disciplinary fashion. So one thing that comes to mind is that in 2006, there were these massive May Day protests that were generated largely by immigrant communities, like a day without an immigrant protests all around the nation. They were huge. And then we had spectacular workplace raids that happened within 3 weeks. And so this kind of push-pull, again, that's not a new thing. I will say this, like, I don't think the Trump administration is creative at all. They are just using well-worn tactics that have used in the past and pouring gasoline onto them. That addition, that influx of gasoline into these infrastructures and into these ICE officers and all of this activity absolutely makes a difference. I'm not saying that it's just same. There is an escalation. That escalation is terrifying. It is horrifying to witness. It is very difficult to fight back against, but it is not new.
And Luke, one thing you had highlighted, well, first of all, the funding, the spending, but also this militarized drive. I mean, that certainly predates 2024, predates Trump 1.0, just in general with policing. I think back to the killing of Michael Brown in Ferguson and the emphasis on all of the military hardware that police forces were purchasing, and then the use of military tactics. How much of this violence then is part of that trend? And generally, it's really more of a question of policing than necessarily just, just immigration. The fact that police forces, they have this type of hardware, and the perception is much more, kind of militarized responses as opposed to what we might call traditional policing responses.
That's a great point. I mean, and this is, you're exactly right. This is not something that's just happened overnight. Since at least the 1970s, when SWAT teams became more prolific, what we've seen is the police, not just federal agencies, but police generally, relying much more heavily on these highly specialized militaristic units, like a SWAT team, for example. And that's problematic for a number of reasons. And not only that, I mean, police departments and then, of course, federal agencies are actually using military equipment. So they'll repurpose military trucks and MRAPs and things like that. And so it's problematic for a couple of reasons. But the main reason, or at least one of the main reasons, is it's optics, right? So if you have swarms of officers who are wearing helmets and masks and dark clothes and ballistic vests just roaming around your streets, it naturally feels like you're being occupied. So if there is a goal for popular legitimacy and trust in the community when that's being policed, it's impossible to see how you would think that that would happen when you're being occupied by that sort of force. And then if you look at getting back to the specific issue at hand, how ICE was operating, it's not this is relatively new to have masked ICE officers who you cannot identify. And some of these masks, by the way, have skulls and various things like that. That's relatively new, right? And we've all heard the reasons why that's happening. But if there's no high-risk situation, to be decked out in this sort of gear, roaming the streets in broad daylight, dealing with crowd control and protests, is obviously sending a horrific message to the community. And there's no chance of having any sort of public trust or legitimacy in that community.
You listen to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're talking about ICE, Homeland Security, triggered by Kristi Noem's firing. But broadly, what has U.S. immigration policy been? What's been the trend? Our guests today are Naomi Paik. She's from the University of Illinois Chicago, and Luke William Hunt from the University of Alabama. Naomi, part of what you're describing here, certainly immigrant communities have seen, have faced the brunt of a lot of these enforcements, like you had highlighted. But it seems like one thing that is relatively recent has been the broader resistance to immigration. So, what's the possibility that ICE has gone so far and therefore raised people's ire about what's happening to immigration communities, and therefore maybe the discourse changes because there's just simply more resistance?
No, I think that's a great question. I just want to say briefly with what Luke was just mentioning that, okay, we need to think about the militarization of police as a longstanding project and also one that was escalated once the war on terror began. So there is this traffic between what the United States does abroad and what the United States does at home, right? And the traffic between these things.
And actually, one quick thing I want to jump in is that's when ICE was created, right? As a result of
Correct.
the war on terror. So, so clearly, that's an escalation.
Yes. And then I also wanted to point out, since Luke highlighted the Michael Brown lynching, I want to say that what we're seeing being deployed against immigrant communities of all different kinds of backgrounds, there has been a war on Black people for since the beginning. And so on many of these tactics that we're seeing, like, ramming in people's doors without any kind of warrant. Black people have been dealing with this since the beginning, the whole time, by regular police. Regular police. Okay. So I just want to bring that up. Okay. So the resistance. I do, wherever there is oppression, there is resistance. Okay. The oppression is so spectacular and so intense, especially in places like obviously Minnesota, Chicago, Los Angeles, DC, places like this, that it is going to generate resistance, right? We are already seeing different shifts in public opinion that at around 50%, it's never been this high, 50% of of these polls are showing that people support the idea of abolishing ICE, right? I think we need to go harder on pushing that narrative that ICE is actually unnecessary, that when it was created in 2003, people in DHS, this behemoth disorganized organization, weren't even quite clear what the purpose of ICE was because we already had Border Patrol, right? Customs and Border, which was renamed Customs and Border Protection. So people were thinking, why do we need this other agency? What is it for? I think we need to go back to that question that has been not from people, immigrant justice organizations, but from within the government asking those questions. I also want to say that the resistance did not start with Donald Trump. So the fact I live in Chicago, the fact that Chicago, Tom Homan was whining on Fox News, basically saying, people know their rights. They call it know your rights training. I call it anti-ICE training. Okay. So those know your rights trainings didn't come out of nowhere. There's a lot of history of organizing, not only in migrant justice communities, but also in Black communities and oppressed communities in Chicago that can get reactivated, right, in the time of crisis. So all of these networks for rapid response teams, for know your rights trainings, which also do things like canvassing, like getting the information out there, making sure that affected communities have this information, all of that, it didn't come out of nowhere. It came out from deep roots that migrant justice organizers have built over many years, right? And so we're seeing an escalation of that. We're seeing more ordinary people just show up and want to be part of this because they can't tolerate seeing this violence done against their own people. But I think that we need to keep building and keep pushing and keep educating people that even when Trump goes away, that does not solve the problem. He already went away. And then what happened? Biden increased the budget by $25 billion to ICE, right? He shut down asylum claims, right? He shut down the southern border. He was violating international law and doing all of these things. So we need to think about less about it's in some ways it's helpful to have a figurehead enemy to focus our attention, but we also need to think about the broader structures at stake and dismantling those structures from the inside out.
And Luke, I know whenever issues have come up, whether it's about resistance to the police, protests, even, speaking against the police, it always gets framed then as sort of police security versus, citizen security. I think of Black Lives Matter spawning Blue Lives Matter and framing it in that way. And so ultimately, I guess the way in which defenders of police forces have always framed this is, well, you want to protect the police, right? But we've seen some pretty audacious killings, the killings in Minnesota at the top of that list, but I mean, killings in numerous cities. Do you see any crack in that framing of the issue of, either you defend the protesters or you defend the police, and instead the need for professionalization of police or fewer police or whatever way that you might be able to reframe that?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, I mean, a couple of big picture points. I mean, this idea of, protesting is somehow being problematic is, of course, completely absurd. That's one of the fundamental rights we have in this country. First Amendment rights is to assemble and to protest and express our discontent with the government. Of course, there's a line that you draw there when it crosses over to criminality. And you don't have a right to break the law, but you certainly have a right to protest. And I think what we're seeing is just, I'm looking at this from more of a law enforcement perspective than sort of a broader political question and historical question. We're seeing law enforcement officers who just are ill-equipped to handle protests and crowds because, frankly, that's not what federal agents are trained to do, and we're putting them in a situation where they have no idea what they're doing. And so, to your question about whether we're seeing some cracks and sort of picking sides, it's difficult to say, but I certainly think I've seen some shift away from this in the sense of after the killings of Renee Good and Alex Preddy, when the administration officials immediately jumped on camera and defended those acts and described them as domestic terrorists. I think you saw a broad swath of the public just in shock because they watched the videos. And even without a legal training or a background in law enforcement, it was very clear to see that there, at a minimum, deep questions about whether the police were justified in using force. And in fact, whether there was a reasonable belief that they could have had that their life was an imminent threat for them to be justified in using lethal force. And whatever side you're on, I think people who watch those videos, you can say, look, it's plausible that this is a serious legal question that at a minimum needs to be investigated to see whether this was justified or not. And most people are coming down on the side and saying, look, I'm looking at the facts, I'm looking at the law, and there's no way I can justify that. So I do, in that sense, I think there's been a little bit of a shift, and you've even seen slight breaks in the administration when they tried to backtrack on some of the descriptions of what they were doing as domestic terrorism and that sort of thing. And one can only hope that we'll sort of make bet more progress in that direction.
One of the huge issues in Minnesota is whether or not local officials can investigate the killing of Renee Good, Alex Preddy, versus the federal government, and how much must they share that information. That has been kind of an ongoing political struggle between the two. First of all, where is that now? And do you anticipate at least the idea that local officials will have the ability to try to hold federal officials' feet to the fire when there are these kinds of killings?
That's a great question. So it's difficult because when you have such a breakdown between, the federal government on the one hand, the Department of Justice, for example, and in particular the Civil Rights Division, which typically would investigate these sorts of killings. And we've seen from the beginning that basic blanket statements that the Civil Rights Division is not going to pursue these things. And of course, as a result, we've seen some mass resignations and that sort of thing. So the problem is that we seem to have a Department of Justice who is not taking seriously their job, or at least the prosecutors who wanted to were held back from doing that. They're not taking seriously their job to investigate serious cases where there's been an abuse of federal rights. So that leaves the question of where are we or what can we do at the state level? And it's possible, of course, that you could bring state charges and as a workaround from the federal government. The difficulty is when the federal government takes control of these investigations and is not in a cooperative spirit, it's very difficult to sort of build the kind of case you want, especially with this sort of outside political influence. So I'm not especially optimistic that we're going to get the kind of investigation we would like. But again, if we don't, that just is another instance of a huge breakdown in the rule of law and a lack of accountability.
Naomi, I'd be remiss to not ask this big, broad question that I think highlights your work, your research, and what you've been arguing here. And that is, there's been this focus on the use of force against immigrant communities. But the one question that it seems that Americans really need to answer is immigration broadly good for the country? Are immigrants a problem? Because sometimes the issue gets framed behind, well, we fully support legal immigration. It's people without documentation or illegal immigration. But then when you push it further, it seems that that argument is kind of a precursor to, well, but do we want all of these immigrants? My question for you then, first of all, do you agree that sort of at the end of the day, the big question that we really haven't wrestled with that we need to is the ways in which immigration are good for this country, are is enriching for the country, and with that in mind, the need to protect immigrant communities broadly because they're communities that need to be cherished.
Yeah, absolutely. And just to respond to some of what Luke was saying, okay, investigation is fine, but can we just admit reality that Alex Pretty and Renee Nicole Good were slaughtered in cold blood by these officers and that there's clear evidence of that? And I just want to state the obvious, like, and an investigation, even if there were people in the DOJ who would investigate, how does that hold ICE? How does that hold DHS accountable? A couple cops get fired, and that's it. It doesn't actually undo the structures and mechanisms that led to those lynchings to begin with. So I just wanted to make that clear. And let me just say, in my opinion, I'm obviously not talking from a cop perspective, but there is no amount of training that can fix this problem. The problem is the fact that these agencies exist with the mandate to police immigrants. Okay, so now let's get to your question about Americans need to deal with this question. What is the role of immigration in our country? For me, it is quite obvious that immigration and diversity makes us a more resilient and strong country because we have more resources of, in terms of life experiences, in terms of, different ways of thinking and being in the world that make us stronger. I work at a university that is incredibly diverse, and I have learned more since moving here than I have at my previous three institutions, which were the approach to diversity was more like, how much can we bring in without ultimately changing what we are as predominantly white institutions? And so I have learned so much more from my students because they're coming from everywhere. And so if we think about agency being about the capacity to use the wherewithal of everyday life, then the fact that you are diversifying and having lots more different kinds of people means that you have a greater wherewithal to move forward together, to problem solve. You might have more experienced people who have dealt with a certain problem, like the rise of fascism, than we would without them, right? So to me, it seems quite clear that immigration is a good thing. I could rattle off different kinds of, facts that are I don't find particularly helpful, but that, immigrants are good for the economy. Actually, immigrant businesses generate more wealth for a community. I could talk about like how, even if you want to look at crime statistics or whatever, Immigrants commit fewer crimes than citizen people. Fine, you can have those statistics. We have known these for quite some time. They have not moved the needle. So I think we need to think about who are we as a country? Not only who have we been as a country, but where do we want to be and where do we want to go as a country? The other problem is that the United States, I think, fundamentally has an accountability problem, that we do not want to be held accountable in any way at all whatsoever for the wealth that we have in this country. We're the most powerful, richest country the world has ever seen. That, again, did not come out of our own ingenuity. It comes from imperialism and colonialism. It comes from different kinds of trade agreements. It comes from military action. All of those things that secure resources in the US interest end up displacing people. Where do those people go? A lot of them don't come to the US. They go to neighboring countries, but a lot of them do come to the US. That is a form of accountability to those people for making their lives unlivable where they were already living. So I think that's the harder nut to crack, is trying to get the US Americans to understand that we actually have a responsibility for creating the conditions that generate migration to begin with. And I think we have a real problem of holding ourselves accountable for anything whatsoever.
And Luke, I'm going to give you the last word on that question, broadly about questions about accountability and also about questions, I think, fundamentally on American identity, including identity on our engagement with law enforcement.
Thanks. So I would certainly echo what Naomi said about the value of immigration and the value of diversity in this country and how that's the heart of who we are as a country. Broadly, politically, I think there is a debate that a lot of Americans are having between, on the one hand, being in favor of immigration, but also at the same time, wanting some sort of security at the border and wanting to figure out a way, something that works, right? And that's the debate we're having. You know, when it comes to law enforcement specifically, and as I and Naomi mentioned, when it comes to accountability, I think one of the biggest things we have going for this country is a commitment, in spirit at least, to the rule of law. And by the rule of law in this context, what I mean is accountability for our government officials. And so it is important to me, even when we see videos that are horrific, that we explain to the public the legal standards and how we get to where we're going to get to prosecute people and what it takes to use legal force and when you ought not use legal force. And explaining those procedures and investigating those things and not just, you know, blanketly saying it's good or bad and leaving it at that is the core of who we are as a country, because we are not just beholden to official whim, we're beholden to the law. And I think that's my biggest worry, is that erosion that we're just seeing, basically executive power being wielded without accountability and without a commitment to the rule of law.
And I think all of this, certainly this last conversation, so resonates with me, my own interesting questions of identity, security, remaining consistent with the values. At the end of the day, I think the broader question about American treatment of immigrants, American treatment of the rule of law, says something very, very important in the big broad question: who are we as Americans? Who are we as the United States? And so I think what's at stake here is nothing less than what it means to be American, what it means to be the United States. And so, as far as I'm concerned, that makes this maybe the most important issue that
That's
we're
right.
facing today. We've been talking about the Department of Homeland Security, about ICE raids, about immigration, broadly about the history of American policy towards immigration, American policy, towards policing and holding police accountable. Our guests today have been Naomi Paik. She is Associate Professor of Global Asian Studies and Criminology, Law and Justice at the University of Illinois, Chicago. She's the author of Bans, Walls, Raids, Sanctuary: Understanding U.S. Immigration for the 21st Century, and Rightlessness: Testimony and Redress in U.S. Prison Camps Since World War II. And Luke William Hunt. He's Associate Professor of Philosophy at the University of Alabama. He's the author of The Police Identity Crisis: Hero, Warrior, Guardian, Algorithm, and Police Deception and Dishonesty: The Logic of Lying. Thank you both so much for sharing your time, your expertise, and your incredibly thought-provoking responses. Thank you for the conversation.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Thank you so much for having us.
This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org, and I'm Maria Armudian. How does immigration law and the border define national identity and belonging? Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. What exactly are the political, physical, and existential meanings of borders and of immigration policy? I mean, borders are human creations, but they'll define state and national boundaries. They define identities. They help to determine where a nation exists. And immigration policy asks the question, who a nation is? Who belongs to the nation? Under this administration, borders have become the most visible feature of policy. They're all over the news, but also addresses the question, who belongs in the United States? Our first guest has written a new book on borders and their impact on conversations and policies on immigration and what it means to belong to a nation. Hiroshi Motomura is the Susan Westerberg Prager Distinguished Professor of Law at the University of California, Los Angeles. His publications include Immigration Outside the Law, and his latest book is Borders and Belonging Towards a Fair Immigration Policy. Professor Motomura, thank you very much for joining us. Please.
Thank you for inviting me. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about this.
Thanks. And my first question, knowing that you are a professor of law and opening the book thinking it's going to walk through a lot of specific nuances of immigration law, I was admittedly very pleased to find that it was really a much broader exploration about the law of values, what it means to be a part of the nation. So first of all, the title is Borders and Belonging. How does immigration law help us to understand who belongs in the nation, you know, who's in the nation, who's not in the nation?
Well, there are many ways we could, you know, take this apart in terms of the law and belonging, or as the title of the book suggests, borders and belonging. And some of this implicates really what law does. You know, I'm glad you mentioned that the book, you know, I guess it's written by a law professor, but a lot of my concern really is sort of the work that law does in defining belonging. And let me just name a couple of things and then we can continue the conversation. But one of the things that law does is it defines at some level who's a citizen, who's supposed to be in the United States. It defines who's going to have status and who doesn't have status. And then that instigates a whole conversation about what you call people without status. Are they unauthorized, irregular, undocumented? Some people use the word illegal. And so in that sense, the law does a lot of work there. But one of the things that the book is really about is how the law is also a mask, or how it conceals things, right? I mean, history is full of examples of things being labeled against the law or consistent with the law, and things that over time we've come to accept as unjust. I mean, one of the most prominent ones in American history is slavery, of course. But so the book tries to show how the law in some ways makes things normal, at least in a given era, makes things normal that are actually deeply unjust. And how the law, in a sense, is a cover for injustice. So in that sense, I believe that many of the people who are, you know, who lack immigration status, many of the undocumented people in the United States, whatever word we use, they have been illegalized in some sense by the law. And I think some of the things we're seeing in the current administration are making things seem wrong, seem illegal, when in fact, either that's wrong because they actually are legal, but even if they're not fully legal, they result from a history that has a lot of injustice behind it. And so much of the book is about What are the, in fact, the book ends with a chapter that includes an express discussion of what are the wrongs that borders conceal. And that's another way of saying, what are the wrongs that the law can conceal? All that said, I think the law can be a force for good, if it's done right.
It seems that when we think about immigration, we think about populations, over borders, it's fair to say that there's at least two baskets here. One is, might we call it kind of normal immigration, migration, labor migrations, et cetera. And the other is, you refer to forced migrations or, responses to some sort of catastrophe or disaster or a conflict, or something else. And when it comes to sort of how accepting a nation should be of migrants, of immigrants, those tend to be treated differently. So, is that a fair distinction? And should we separate those two categories? Kind of fleeing a war is simply different than, seeking employment.
Yeah, there are a lot of angles on this, but one of the things that the book talks about, and I guess it's chapters 2 and 3, is that much of conversation about migration does divide up into what some people think of as special treatment for people who are refugees, and then less generous treatment for everybody else. And that has a lot of different layers. One layer, by the way, which is something the book tries to push back against generally, is that the immigration field has been, I suppose you could say, written about, talked about, discussed, and argued about in silos in some sense. I mean, a lot of the refugee specialists don't necessarily talk to the people who work on labor migration, and the labor migration and refugee people don't necessarily talk to, economists. And so there's a lot of siloing going on. And so one of the silos is the one you actually one that you name, which is that, refugees and so-called migrants or all other migrants, there's a tendency to treat them very differently. And I think that's fundamentally corrosive or destructive and doesn't lead to comprehensive look at policy. But to be more specific, a lot of the way we think about refugees and treating refugees emerged from World War II in Europe. So in that sense, it was a solution with European origins, and it was emerged from the Holocaust and from the displacement of people in World War II. And I think there's a lot of collective shame about that, or at least a desire to, quote, do something, end quote. And I think that that's the origin of a refugee system that protects people in a relatively generous way. And if you get asylum, you get a permanent residence, in other words, a green card, and are on the path to citizenship. But everyone who doesn't qualify is kind of cast out there, and there's not a lot of regard for the very dire straits that they're in. So the result of that is that you have an exception, but there's never, it was always seen as an exception and a very narrow exception. And everyone else is subject to sort of kind of a closed door national sovereignty. We may let you in to work, but maybe we won't. And what that's created here is a situation. This really feels like a mid-20th century solution. And the reason I put it that way is that now we have a huge variety of situations around the world that range from, as you mentioned, from civil war to, and we're going to see more climate change refugees. And many of them don't fit into the narrow boxes that we've created. And that calls for rethinking what protection is. It calls for understanding that refugees aren't just people, victims and survivors. They're also people who contribute to society in various ways. And it calls for more transnational cooperation. I mean, a lot of countries, actually, in both in any stream of immigration, a lot of countries try to go on their own. And we're seeing now that, well, we should have seen, years ago, but there's much more of a obvious need for cooperation between countries. Although much of that, I should say, tends to be countries are much more effective in cooperating on enforcement than they are in cooperating on actually addressing, what it means to, create circumstances where people feel forced to leave. They don't really feel they have a choice, and so we're in this moment where where the system is really breaking down at a lot of different levels, and yet we have two things. One is a lot of gridlock on decision making, and to be blunt about it, we have politicians who can exploit the gridlock and profit in some sense, maybe certainly politically, maybe monetarily on the fact that it's broken.
You listen to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're discussing a new book titled Borders and Belonging: Toward a Fair, Realistic, and Sustainable Immigration Policy with its author, Hiroshi Motomuro of the University of California, Los Angeles. Early in the book, you talk about the difference between one of the big questions with migration, temporary or permanent. So the way this gets framed, whether it's refugees or even guest worker type programs, the idea that you can come over the border either because you're fleeing a conflict or a disaster or because you're doing work we don't want to do, but the expectation is you're going to return, as opposed to you are moving here and becoming a part of our nation. And immediately I thought, again, the framing of this around belonging seems quite central. Where are we, the way that we silo those two communities? It seems like that's a pretty significant difference.
There's a couple of things in your question, and one of them is people who study migration have long talked about whether people should be allowed to come temporarily, whether people should be thought of, as more permanent, or I use in the book the word indefinite, but it's really practically the difference between temporary and permanent. And a couple of things here. One is that I think guest workers have been the site of a lot of abuse of workers. I mean, it's very clear that certainly in the United States and in many countries around the world, temporary workers are put in a very vulnerable and exploitable situation. For example, the very fact that you lose your immigration status if you no longer hold the same job gives a lot of power to the employer, who can basically extract things from their workforce that they couldn't extract from other people. So in that sense, temporary worker programs have gotten, I think, justifiably a bad name. But that's only part of the story. I think that in many respects, the problem with immigration policies that now exist, there's a huge gap between the people we let in to work and the numbers of people who really can contribute to this country by working. And so one of the ways we solve that is to have temporary workers, and if the choice is between lawful temporary workers and essentially illegalizing the workers that we have, then I'd rather have the people with at least a minimal degree of legal security by giving them temporary lawful status as workers, but with better labor protections than they now have. But that's one set of things. But I'm also understand that many of the people who come temporarily end up staying. And some people who, especially those who are skeptical of immigration, say, well, they almost basically claim to be deceived. Someone once quipped that there's nothing more permanent than temporary workers. And one part of the things I'm saying in the book is that sounds like it's hypocritical or deceptive, but actually it's not. It's really a reflection of how people make decisions. And people come, with some expectation of staying for a brief period of time. But I believe that one of the things that's important for society is to not to marginalize the people who are here. And I think there's nothing contradictory between an initial admission as a temporary worker and then saying, if you've really worked here for a period of time, you put your roots in the community, you have children here who are citizens by virtue of birth on U.S. soil, then there's a point in which we should rethink that and allow more people to stay. But here's the next piece of this, which a different chapter explores. I think this is all about, over the course of a generation or two, giving people a real choice. In other words, the question is there a way, and this is the least exploitative thing, is to let people work, but also give them a legitimate choice between two things that are positive. One is to stay, also the choice to go back, but have it be a free choice. This all goes to creating conditions in the country that they've left originally, conditions that actually give people a real choice. In fact, over time, give people a choice to stay at home. Because a lot of people go through this process of really agonizing, not only about leaving their homes, but also making a dangerous journey. And I want to both create the conditions where people are treated humanely when they come and contribute, really do have a choice to go back, and then also have the opportunity, the choice to stay at home. I mean, these are all about giving migrants free choices instead of subjecting them to two things. One is a more economic exploitation. That's one problem. And the other is the use of that exploitation as a way to extract labor from other parts of the world without really taking full responsibility in this country. So, one of the things I talk about in the beginning of the book is a realistic utopia, the idea. I mean, the utopian world, it's a world in which people have choices to cross borders or not, where the incentives are not the ones between life and death. But at the same time, people have a choice to stay at home. That's the utopian part. The realistic part is I'm trying to work with the structures that we have. We have temporary worker programs and things like that. And I'm also trying to come up with a system that, or at least a way of making choices that reflects the structure that we're in, which is we have nation states, we have borders that are used, I think, very unjustly, and I think we should think about ways, step by step, increment by increment, to make them more just. And it's a long process, but I think that that's the realistic part.
Yeah,
I could have written a book explaining why we should completely open all borders, but I'm trying to figure out what are the steps to get there.
Hiroshi, also tied to this question about belonging, it seems that nations, throughout the world, certainly this is true in the US, but we see this all over, they have different political, social responses to migrants, migration patterns, et cetera. Some communities are welcomed with open arms. Others, there's quite a bit of pushback, which is why I think this concept of belonging is so important. So, first of all, how do we manage that? There's clearly racial implications, there's linguistic, religious implications, and historical implications as to who we're welcoming and who we're not. And it's typical that nations will respond to immigrants on these, on this basis. How do we overcome the obvious biases and then draft policies that are just more just?
Well, one theme here goes back to what you're saying, or asking about the role of law here, the role of law and belonging. I think that a lot of people in the United States don't realize the extent to which immigration and citizenship rules, regulations, who can immigrate, who can, become a citizen, how racially discriminatory they were over American history. You couldn't naturalize according to an 1790 law that was restricted naturalization to free white persons. Restrictions on racial restrictions in the naturalization laws to become a citizen were not taken out of U.S. citizenship law until 1952. So I think that some of this is excavating those facts, but I don't think that's enough. I think we need to have a conversation about some of the basic legal principles we have that were that come out of these kinds of discriminatory episodes. And so what happens, in the mid 20th century is that the law has much less, maybe some people say no more explicit racial discrimination. But the difficulty is that the mismatch we have between the legal pathways, in other words, the lines to stand in, the mismatch we have between that and what we're willing to wink and nod at in letting people work without papers, and that's true even in spite of recent efforts to enforce more. Those things emerge from a policy that for many years has treated migrant workers and particularly labor migration from Mexico as a disposable workforce. And so I think that a lot of this is a question of excavating the history and having conversations. One of the things that's a fundamental to the entire book is that many people, including immigrants' rights advocates, I think are buying into a misleading concept of immigration law. I mean, a lot of people think about immigration law as the legal version of a wall. They're outsiders, those are them. They're insiders, that's us. And the purpose of the border wall, the purpose of immigration law is to protect us from people on the outside. And actually, what immigration law does is it really should be thought of as a conversation among people who are here, about who should come in and who should join the community and how the community should take shape over the years. And when you start thinking about that way, then you can actually have an honest conversation about how much do we want to carry over from prior history, how much that kind of thing. It also, I think, elevates sanctuary jurisdictions as actually ways to understand an enhanced role of state and local government in inclusion, things like that. And so I think this is the kind of debate that's happening around the world now, because I think that there's a way of thinking about this that is a debate that's happening. And one last thing that just occurred to me in response to your question is that there's a lot of talk about whether it's an immigration crisis. And that itself is kind of a misleading way to think about it, because then conversation becomes, well, how bad is it, right? Is it really bad, or is it unprecedentedly bad, or is it just kind of the way it works bad? But the real question is, how can we share immigration prosperity, the prosperity that immigration brings? And when you think about the immigration law as a version of the border wall, then you think about, oh, how bad is it? But when you think about it as a way to share immigration prosperity, then you think about things much more in a way of understanding the opportunities that immigrants provide. And I think it's challenging actually to share the prosperity that immigration brings. But I think that's the challenge, not how many people can we keep out.
No, absolutely. The title of the book is Borders and Belonging: Toward a Fair, Realistic, and Sustainable Immigration Policy. The author is Hiroshi Motomura. He's the Susan Westerberg Prager Distinguished Professor of Law at the University of California, Los Angeles. Thank you very, very much for joining us.
Thank you for the conversation.
Thank you.
And that's it for today's program. Thank you for listening. The Scholar Circle is hosted by Doug Becker. Its managing producer is Ankina Agassian. Seb Dongre is our webmaster and assistant producer. Our archives are at scholarcircle.org, and our podcasts are on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on at Scholar Circle or me at Armudian and join our Facebook page. I'm the founder, anchor, and occasional host, Maria Armudian.